This is The Crisis Point.
Welcome to The Crisis Point Podcast, where, like Chesterton, we only discuss politics and religion because, well, there's nothing else to discuss. I am Michael Warren Davis, the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine, and I am joined by my co-host, Philip F. Lawler, the director of the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture. Phil, how are you?
I'm in fine fettle today.
Our topics for today, we're going to be discussing the riots that have broken out in every major American city and the Catholic Church leadership's, frankly, lame response, and also the plans to track the COVID outbreak using parish resources that could potentially threaten not only the privacy of individual Catholics, but the integrity of the Church in America itself. So, Phil, I'm sure that you read Wilton Gregory, the Archbishop of Washington, D.C.'s astonishing statement on President Trump visiting the shrine of John Paul II to sign a historic piece of legislation guaranteeing religious freedom. And Archbishop Gregory, as you know, said that it was the Catholic Church was allowing itself to be used as a prop by this president at a time when he very strongly implied that President Trump was part of this systemic racism that has, you know, allegedly caused the outbreak of these riots. What do you make of that?
Archbishop Gregory's statement was inexcusably ignorant and partisan. It was a disgrace. He didn't take the time to get the facts. The facts were that President Trump had made plans some time ago, before this whole incident erupted, to go to the St. John Paul II Center and issue an executive order on religious freedom. Religious freedom is, by the way, something that the Catholic Church supports. So, without any controversy or reservation, it's not that some Catholics support it. All Catholics support the international quest for religious freedom. That's what this was about. I'm astonished that Archbishop Gregory didn't get the facts before putting out a statement, particularly because that shrine is run by the Knights of Columbus, who have been very generous and solicitous toward the Catholic hierarchy. And with a minimum of courtesy, the Archbishop would have called them and asked them, what's the story, before he had his outburst.
Very true. And I feel like, I don't know, Phil, do you think that Archbishop Gregory would have changed his tone if he had known any of this beforehand? Because as we were saying before we started recording, I try to be very judicious in my criticism of the bishops. I don't like to do it. It makes me uncomfortable. But I also feel like if you only criticize bishops when they really deserve it, it's more impactful. If you know, I hate that word, but I think it's true in a sense. Archbishop Gregory just strikes me as a very bad actor. And what has he done since he became the Archbishop of Washington? For one, there has been no substantial investigation into Cardinal McCarrick's connections. There has been absolutely no substantial action or investigation into Cardinal Wuerl's involvement. What he's done is he's closed the churches en masse to prevent the spread of coronavirus or whatever. And now he's told the President of the United States they shouldn't be allowed to go into a major Catholic shrine in his diocese. He's spent his entire episcopacy telling people not to come into the church, whereas most bishops you would think would want people to come into the church.
You would think so. And when he said that it was so unfortunate, baffling and reprehensible was his phrase, baffling and reprehensible. Those are strong words. Speaking of reprehensible, to try to use the Catholic Church in this way as a political prop, and you probably saw online the day after the photos of Archbishop Gregory sitting in his cathedral while Nancy Pelosi gave a eulogy from his ambo, you know, from his cathedral, from his lectern, and if that isn't using the Catholic Church I mean, any time you have Nancy Pelosi presenting herself at Mass, you have an abuse, an exploitation of the Catholic Church, to which he seems to be blind. And if he doesn't like President Trump, I understand. Lots of people don't like President Trump. But let's be at least a little bit even-handed here. This was grotesquely partisan.
Archbishop Gregory is one of those bishops that has been outspoken in saying that, as you, for instance, Nancy Pelosi, that pro-choice politicians should not be denied communion. But again, this is a man who, because he doesn't agree with Trump's, I don't even think his racial politics, just his racial sensibilities, he thinks that President Trump is insufficiently woke on racial issues, and so he doesn't even want him to go into the church. He doesn't want him to step foot in a shrine, let alone, I mean, denying communion. There's absolutely no instance in which a bishop can say, no, I don't think that this person is morally or sort of philosophically correct enough to even step foot in a church.
It's exactly. This is something that occurred to me. Yes. Isn't the church for sinners? Mm. And if you think that Donald Trump is a sinner, all the more reason to rejoice when he goes to a shrine to pray. It's a, any way you look at it, it's a step in the right direction. What he did that day, he went to a shrine to pray. Was it just a photo op? Was he sincere? I don't know, but it's not a bad thing. It's not a bad photo op. And while he was there, by the way, let's keep it in mind, he signed this executive order freeing up the resources of the United States government to fight for religious freedom of Christians abroad. That's a good thing. What he was doing there was a good thing. It's not the time to issue a denunciation.
And do you remember, it was only a year or two ago, when those senators were very strongly, it was Mays, Hirono, and Kamala Harris, were strongly suggesting that Knights of Columbus shouldn't be allowed to hold public office because they considered the Knights of Columbus a far-right sect. These are people who are very close to Speaker Pelosi. And while in Archbishop Gregory, instead of, as you say, instead of giving the courtesy to the Knights of Columbus, to what he did was he shunned the Knights and he embraced a woman who's the leader of a political sect that despises the Catholic Church and everything that it stands for.
Right. It's indefensible. It's baffling and reprehensible.
I don't know if you really read much about the St. John Church, the Church of the President, the Church of the Presidents, I guess they call it, the church, the Episcopal Church that is right across the street from the White House. Now, President Trump got into a bit of hot water because he was he had the police clear out protesters from the area, so that, and he posed for that iconic, now iconic photo of him standing there just sort of holding a Bible aloft, and the lady vicars of the Episcopal Church in D.C. and the Bishop Bess both had a field day. They were furious. And saying that, you know, President Trump desecrated this space, this is a place of peace, all of this was reported by Religion News Service and all these New York Times, Washington Post. I didn't see a single report that mentioned that the day before, protesters had lit the church on fire.
Right. Nor did you see much, you saw quite a bit about the tear gas that was used. Right. There was no tear gas used. You saw a great deal about how President Trump wanted it cleared out. It wasn't President Trump. It was the Park Service that wanted it cleared out because of the threat of violence. And the threat of violence was very credible because there had been violence the day before. Was it a political event for President Trump? Of course. Everything a politician does is political. He's not the first one to wave a Bible. He's not the first one to pose like that. I'm not particularly a fan of President Trump. I am, however, a fan of people getting things right and people recognizing that there are occasions, many occasions, when President Trump has served the interests of loyal Catholics much better than his predecessors.
The bishop, the Episcopal bishop, this woman, said that Trump was using the church and the Bible as a prop to make some kind of political statement, which I thought was so rich, because this is a, this these people were condemning the police for clearing out these protesters after they tried to burn down the church. They were effectively saying the church is incidental to the cause. If the mob needs to burn down a church in order to get their message across, that's fine. I don't see, to you and me, churches are God's property, they're not ours. You can't just burn down, you can't give people permission to burn down your church because you happen to agree with their sentiments. I can't think of anyone who would be more likely to use a church as a prop, as something that they can wave around to make a point. You know, let it stay, use it to house protesters and distribute snacks and water bottles and hand sanitizer, or just burn it down, because that would be a nice sim right across from the White House. That'll really drive the message home. Who was really using the churches as a prop? It's clearly not the Episcopal Church, no?
That's an interesting point. I think there are a lot of people in the Episcopal Church and in other churches, including, I'm sad to say, our own, who see opposition to President Trump as their number one priority, superseding any spiritual message, any evangelical message that the church might deliver. And it reminds me, you know, back in the 1980s, I forget exactly when it was, maybe around 1983 or 4, I was invited to speak to a gathering of diocesan justice and peace coordinators. I was one of several people on a panel. And it became clear to me that most of these people, most of the people who were listening to us, had opposition to President Ronald Reagan as their top priority. And so when it came my point to speak, at one point I said, you know, the Catholic Church does have an enemy more fearsome than Ronald Reagan. And nobody seemed to get it. I think most of those people were genuinely puzzled. What is he talking about?
I would never accuse a bishop of being an atheist. But to circle back to Wilton Gregory, you remember the statement that he made when he was closing the churches in D.C., where he said, the health and safety of my flock is my number one concern.
Right.
And as I think we talked about this last time, it was sort of a, I don't know, I felt like that was a challenge. It's, you know, it's like spot the atheist in the Catholic hierarchy. How could any bishop say that his first concern is for the physical health of his flock?
I'm reminded of something that the late Father Richard John Newhouse said, that someone said, oh, that was a slip of the tongue. And he said, yeah, but in this case, it was a slip of the tongue because there was a slip of the mind, and there was a slip of the mind because there was a slip of the soul.
Mm. I like that. Yeah, and again, Archbishop Gregory's relationship with God is between him and God. But he doesn't speak and act as a man whose episcopacy is grounded in supernatural faith. And I don't say that lightly, but he has caused demonstrable harm to the Catholic Church since he's taken, in the short amount of time since he's taken over. And let's not even get into his career as head of the USCCB and all that. This is really, truly a dangerous influence in the church hierarchy.
Agreed. Yes.
I want to know who made the recommendation. It must have been Cardinal Wuerl.
Well, good question. Or is there someone, say, a predecessor of Cardinal Wuerl, who still has influence through back channels in Rome?
That would be extraordinary, and not surprising.
Not at all surprising. We're still waiting for that report on McCarrick. It was promised 18 months ago.
Don't hold your breath. I would be genuinely surprised if the report came out, A, and I will eat my hat if, B, there is a single piece of information that we hadn't already heard from the New York Times to LifeSite News. You know, they will not volunteer damaging information.
We'll see.
Now this, Phil, this is a topic that you selected that I hadn't even heard of, I'm sorry to say. The COVID tracking through parishes. Tell us about that.
Well, it's okay. The idea is that in a number of dioceses, the faithful are told that in order to come to Mass, they need to reserve a spot. So they need to call or go online, depending, and give their names to reserve a place at Mass. So there's a roster of everybody who's gone to Mass. I've also heard the same thing for going to confession, which is even more egregious, because confession should be private and anonymous. But in any case, you have a roster of people who've gone to Mass. If anyone who attended the same Mass tests positive for the coronavirus, then you have an obvious situation where the coronavirus trackers are going to say, can I have a list of everybody who went to Mass that day? And that frightens me on several levels, as an invasion of privacy, as an invasion of confidentiality, as a situation where the church becomes sort of an arm of the state. And, you know, we said this earlier, anybody should be able to go into a Catholic church. Now, I understand there are restrictions now because of numbers, and so you're not going to crowd people in, and maybe having only parishioners there is one way to do it. But people should be able to go into church regardless. Mm. And as I say, it's even worse if it's tracking people who've been to confession. I mean, imagine someone who is wanted by the police for a crime which he now wants to confess. Imagine, how about this? Imagine an illegal alien, an immigrant, who expects the church to be his friend and goes into church. And now he's going to be called by someone representing the government and asked where he was that day and who are all of his friends and contacts. These are frightening ideas.
What have the bishops done that would suggest that they're willing to stand up to the government?
Exactly my point.
Either because they're patsies or because they're legitimately afraid. And some very innocent but very badly misled bishop says, oh, well, yes, of course, I have a duty to do this. This is what's best for my flock, even if they don't realize it. I could see this going wrong in any number of ways, from malicious intent to very benevolent misguidedness.
Right. Once you put yourself in the position, once you have that list, you put yourself in a position where also the government might subpoena the list. Do you fight the subpoena? The government might say, if you don't keep that list, you have to close the church again. Do you fight that order? Do you say that's religious violation of religious freedom? As you say, nothing that has happened in the last 2 months suggests to me that the bishops would put up the fight.
No, especially because their restrictions are now stricter than the state's. The states are relaxing all these recreational restrictions. Some restaurants are only allowed to be at 50% capacity, but the church is saying we have to be at 40% capacity, even though no one stands at church looking at each other. There's face-to-face. It's just that I think you and I were both very critical of the decision to close in the first place. But these absurd restrictions that are being played, even by very good, solid bishops, not a single diocese is reopened fully. There are still being restrictions being imposed by the churches on themselves. Meanwhile, we're going without the sacraments.
Well, in many cases, yes, yeah. And there's an obvious way around it. You can just say it's a Black Lives Matter protest, and then you can have as many people as you want.
That was the most extraordinary revelation, I think, that has come out of these riots, which is that, you know, 75 conservatives standing outside the State House protesting the lockdowns, we were told, were going to set off the real coronavirus apocalypse. And now hundreds of thousands of people are gathering in cities all over America. Maybe a third of them are wearing masks. And this is not only is this a wonderful expression of free speech and racial equality, but you're a bigot and a fascist if you oppose them. Law-abiding citizens were put under house arrest, and for 3 months. And these looters have been pillaging our major cities for a week, and there have been no arrests, no significant arrests. There have been police officers ambushed, and then the perpetrators are not arrested. It should be clear to everyone now that the government never believed what they were telling us about the necessity for lockdowns.
That's my point, that you have mayors who are telling kids that they shouldn't have pickup basketball games, half a dozen teenage kids, because they were going to cause the next outbreak. But now you have, leave aside the looters, just talk about the peaceful demonstrators who are in close proximity shouting, which we're told is how you create not just a few cases, but what they're talking about, the super spreader events. These would obviously seem to be super spreader events.
Absolutely.
And if they're not, by the way, then that raises questions about the lockdown in the first place.
We're not talking about Muskogee, Oklahoma. We're talking about New York City. We're talking about cities that had major instances of coronavirus. And anyone who, you know, who went out to get a pack of cigarettes more than once every 2 weeks was going to kill at least, you know, 150 little old ladies. So the government, it's not news. The government lied. The problem is that the bishops are complicit in their lies. Anyway, that's all the time we have for this week. I thank you all for joining us. I thank Phil for joining me. And we'll see you again next week. Thank you very much, and God bless you all.